There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
And here we go. Back for round two. I'm Nicole Sandler. Thanks for joining me tonight on Air America Radio. It is now officially Saturday on the East Coast. And so we are into the weekend. And I like to mix things up a little bit in this last hour of the week that we have together. And, joining me on the phone tonight is an old friend. And I thought we would talk a little bit of rock and roll because, well, you know, I like to do that from time to time. Lon Friend, lived the life, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Can I say that, Lon? You were at the helm of Rip Magazine. You were a married man, so you didn't do the sex part of it, did you?
Why are you speaking past tense? I still live life rock and roll.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. You're right. And now you're not a married man anymore, so you get that part of it in there too, right?
Well, the personal and the professional always intertwined. When I was flying on Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses and Aerosmith's airplanes back in the 80s and 90s, I was still a father and had a family at home, and I went back and I was a normal dad, but yeah, I balanced some pretty decadent surroundings with some pretty normal home life. So that's probably why I've survived, is because I balanced. But I got divorced and no one to blame but myself anyway.
Well, there's always two people involved.
Yeah. Yeah. Hi, Nicole. Nice.
Hi, Lon.
Again.
How are you?
I'm really great, and what a wonderful surprise to hear from you that you're in Florida and you're kicking butt on Air America, one of my favorite networks because of its great sense of expression, and I think it's a good fit for you because you were always a rebel.
Always a rebel. And the thing is, when we met, I mean, you know, I've been doing radio forever. And but I was doing rock and roll radio in Los Angeles, although not as loud rock and roll as you've always been into. I like the more eclectic, a little bit mellower stuff, but it's all music and it's all good.
It is all music. And what's funny about my career is that a 7-year period of my life when I ran Rip Magazine for Larry Flint and from 1987 to 1994 branded me as this heavy metal guy when I grew up on the Beatles and Pink Floyd and Genesis and I'm very much an eclectic music fan. But my memoir is Life on Planet Rock, which came out 3 years ago tomorrow, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
It tried to show a wider berth of my life as a music fan, because I don't know if you've met people like me, but we began breathing on February 9th, 1964, when the Beatles played on the Ed Sullivan Show. And that's when we started our musical consciousness, and that's when we started collecting records. And the run that I had with the decadent 80s into the 90s with Guns N' Roses and Metallica, and having lived that kind of almost famous life, that was a magnificent chapter, a very loud chapter. But, you know, it's just one chapter, and I think being a music fan, you go through many environments throughout your life. You morph. Mm-hmm. You're shapeshifters, because we just can't. We can't get up in the morning, and we can't go to sleep at night unless we've had a full, really high colonic dose of rock and roll.
You know, it's funny because I had Howie Klein on the show a few weeks ago, and Howie Klein, of course, when I first met him, he was the president of Reprise Records. And then when the Time Warner deal happened and they bought him out, he took early retirement, and he said he didn't really have to work anymore. And now he's full board into activism, and he writes the Down with Tyranny blog. And it's sort of, you know, I still have to work, but, you know, it all comes all together. I'm still a music lover, but I think I got disillusioned with what radio has become, right, and music radio anyway. And moving back here to Florida, the only thing I had to listen to was Air America, which was just this fledgling network, which had just launched. and I'd be listening to it. And finally, I called the local station. I said, you know, I'm a radio pro. You need to hire me. And you know, the rest, as they say, is history. But people I don't think are listening to radio anymore to get to find new music. I think there are so many other avenues. So music radio has become a very sad shadow of its former self.
Right. Well, I think it has a lot to do with the economic state of the world, and the music business really became a Babylonian metaphor. It imploded upon itself, and people got independent, and technology moved in a direction where we just became a digital playground. And I mean, I remember interviewing Lars Ulrich after he dropped off the petitions to effectively sue his fans when the Napster event exploded in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, I was just talking to him in a park in San Francisco and asking him to explain to his fans what was happening upon the landscape of music and why these things were putting casting a shadow over a form of music that is really about freedom and about independence. And he tried to explain it, but as you know, Metallica went into some dark years after that, and now we've completely live in a new universe of where music comes from and how artists define themselves and how they market themselves and how they create their own music online. I think it's a very exciting time. And I don't know, what you said about, like, you needed a sense of expression and how Howie Klein has become an activist. Well, I started blogging about 5 years ago voraciously, both on MySpace and independently, and I didn't publish any of the work. I just put it out there because I went through this kind of existential period in my life, still am, where I'm taking stock in the bigger picture. Whether it's political or spiritual, there is a bigger picture out there. Music is just a metaphor that's threaded me to, we need something to hang on to as we're coursing through this breakdown of civilization. And you use activism? I respect that. My friend Danny Goldberg was a record company executive, and he's more of an activist now.
At one time, he was the president of Air America Radio.
Yeah, and just a terrific guy. What he does, I saw him in an elevator in New York about 6 months ago, and I said, what are you doing? He goes, well, you know, when Tom Morello needs some management questions, I kind of take care of it and this and that. I go, you Rage Against the Machine's manager? He goes, no, not officially. Officially, I'm really kind of, I wrote my book, and then he sent me his book, which is great. It's called Bumping Into Geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrific memoir, and I sent him my book. And I think this is just about, you know, as we get into our 50s, we just get into a point of evolution where, boy, the stuff that really mattered doesn't matter as much anymore. And, you know, we have to become, like, sort of global in our perspective instead of so minute and what are we chasing the buck and what's our ego doing today. That's kind of where I've become more, you know, symbolic in my writing over the last few years and not as specific. And I guess you could say I'm sort of a spiritual activist more than anything else, but I dig MSNBC and Air America, so that's my sentiment why I get.
Right, and I wouldn't necessarily say I'm an activist, but I'm a concerned citizen.
Yeah.
And what I say, what qualifies me to do this job is the fact that, you know, I've got a brain, I like to read, I've got a natural curiosity, and I've worked in radio for my entire adult life, and so I know how to talk to people, I know how to do interviews, I know how to speak into the microphone and run the controls. So it was the natural progression for me, and also the fact that the kind of radio I did is, you know, those stations are very few and far between.
But you come from like that old Lee Abrams school of freeform FM radio where we just didn't know what was coming next, and the jocks were us. They were,
mm-hmm.
they had lower voices, mm-hmm. but they were doing the same thing at night. They were in their rooms. A lot of them were geeks, and we could tell there was no separation between who was telling us about the music and ourselves. And I
right.
think that's like growing
well,
up.
Because we really loved the music, and that's the thing. That's the reason I got into radio. I mean, in college, I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I said, oh, I love music. I'll do radio. And in fact, in I went to University of South Florida, and it was the station was a classical station, and they gave student government 4 hours a week, Friday and Saturday nights from 11 to 1. And it was called Freeform Radio. And that was my baby during the whole time I was in college. So that was sort of, I always came from that. And then in the real world, I found out, well, no, everything's programmed for you. And, you know, and it, so the type of stations, in fact, where I was working when you and I met, this station KSCA, which doesn't exist any longer, you know, it was the exception rather than the rule. And those stations are even fewer in number now than they were all those years ago.
I had a really precious taste of that when I was on the Westwood One network in 1992 and 93. I had a syndicated show called Pirate Radio Saturday Night, and I was on 5 hours in about 20 markets. And I'll tell you, I programmed it myself. No one put any strings on me. Every artist that was doing anything at the time came through L.A., came to my studio, and that's what it was really about. They played in studio. We had the best time. We had big numbers in a lot of the major markets because that's how people really wanted to hear. I don't think the whole programming of radio served anything except the economic state, you know, the commercialization. I think you got to let a jock or somebody who grew up with music just be free on the radio.
Right, and I think that's why music radio is not prospering right now, because it's all about the bottom line. It's all voice tracked. It's all canned.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think people are going elsewhere to find their music, because they don't have that filter
yeah.
of that disc jockey that they trust, that they say, well, this person, I like what they play.
Yeah.
All right, Lon Friend is with us. We've got to take a break, but we're having fun. His book, The Life on Planet Rock, came out 3 years ago. Well, it's today here on the East Coast. So
yes,
we're celebrating an anniversary, and we're talking about rock and roll. And when we come back, I want some of your most, you know, best name-dropping, outlandish, crazy stories.
All right.
Okay? Lon Friend is with us on Air America Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler.
Nicole Sandler.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Nicole Sandler.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler.
And we are rocking and rolling on this now Saturday morning, at least on the East Coast. It is Nicole Sandler with an old friend. Lon Friend is with us. I met Lon years ago when I was working in radio, music radio in Los Angeles. We had a mutual friend. And in fact, Lon, I think Terry Gladstone is how you got into this business, isn't she? She was the disc jockey that you used to hound on the air, didn't you?
Terry Gladstone, when I was in my senior year at UCLA, was on KEZY-FM. And we got to know each other because I used to listen to her on the radio while I was driving a lab car for Kaiser Permanente, where I worked part-time. I used to deliver specimens around the city for a hospital. And I listened to her, and I just dug the music she played, and I dug her voice, and I called a couple times like a fan.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know her off the air a little bit, and then the night that John Lennon died, December 8th, 1980, we had gone to a Beatles convention together about 6 months prior. I called her, and she was, like most of the world who were fans of the Beatles, were distraught. So I drove down to Anaheim from the San Fernando Valley, and I spent the whole evening down there with her, took calls. Over the years, her husband, Jeff Gelb, and I have become best friends. We've known each other over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just, Terry's a marvelous person. She's wonderful.
And she remains one of my closest friends today, and that's how I met you. But so you were working for Kaiser Permanente, and through this disc jockey who touched something in you, you worked your way into the music industry.
The chronology is very odd because I graduated from UCLA, and this is in my book. I had no gig. I got my degree in sociology, and I didn't have a clue what I was going to do with it. So I worked in the registrar's office part-time. I drove the Kaiser car part-time. And then in 79, I went to see Todd Rundgren do a residency at the Roxy. And he played 7 nights, 2 shows a night. And I went for the first couple of nights. And the owner of the Roxy, Mario, one of the owners of the Roxy, saw me the second night and says, "You've been here all 4 shows." I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Come back tomorrow, I'll let you in." And I came back and I saw every show of the residency. And on the last night, this guy stops me. He says, "I've seen you at every show." I go, "Yeah, who are you?" He goes, "Well, my name's Danny, and I do merchandise for Todd Rundgren. How'd you like to come out on the road with us and sell T-shirts?" I said, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, we're going to have the Utopia Summer Tour." And the next thing I knew, I was out on the road for a month selling shirts for Todd Rundgren. 2 years later, I found myself getting an interview at Hustler magazine through somebody that I knew from UCLA. I did the interview. I got the job as the associate editor, making $16,500 a year my first year, 1982. I spent 14 years with Flint, the first 7 Hustler and Chic magazine. Those are the stories that I haven't published because some of them are not really for mainstream digestion.
Mm-hmm, I'm sure.
But before Althea Flint died, Larry's crazy late wife, she wanted the company to diverse and create a rock and roll magazine. And it was her dream for there to be a publication that spoke to the pop culture. And this was all dumb timing because Rip Magazine started while Althea was still alive. She passed away in July. They were about to kill the magazine in its 6th issue, and I was kind of getting tired of doing, you know, the porn mag. So I walked into the president of the company's office, and I said, "You know, that Rip, let me have it. Just let me, because there's stuff going on, and there's this band, Guns N' Roses, and I know some people hanging out with them, and just let me have the mag and see what happens." And believe me, you want to talk about serendipity. We were the first. We broke Guns N' Roses.
Wow, and the rest is truly history.
It really took place so much. I had no script.
Things happen like that. We got to take a break, Lon, but we'll come back on the other side and pick up right here because it is serendipitous. I think things happen for a reason, and Rip was meant to be yours. We'll continue with Lon Friend in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Listening to Nicole Sandler.
And we are back with Lon Friend. He is an old friend of mine from L.A. And, his biggest claim to fame was his stint, a long stint, as editor-in-chief of Rip Magazine, which he transformed into the biggest, you know, heavy metal rock magazine of all time. Right? Well, I mean, Lon, what other magazines are in that realm?
Well, our competition back in those days were Hit Parader and Circus, Metal Edge, but they didn't have the kind of editorial slant that we had. I treated the hard rock genre like Rolling Stone treated the rock genre. Mm-hmm. And we had the best interviews and the glossiest pictures, and we ran long articles, and we were right there on the cusp of everything. We covered the grunge era when it broke. We covered industrial had the first interviews with Trent Reznor when he came out with Pretty Hate Machine, and the metal years were, you know, glorious. The Def Leppard, the Scorpions. I left and traveled with them while my staff took care of business, and it was a great marriage because the personality that I carried along coming out of Hustler sort of endeared me to that whole decadent genre, and so I was one of theirs right from the get-go.
Right.
And then I went on MTV, you know, 3 years into the publication, I got a spot on MTV, and then 4 years in, I got a spot on, I got a radio show. So I was kind of a multimedia representative of the entire kingdom of hard rock music, and that was an awesome time.
Well, you know, you referenced, right at the beginning of our conversation, you referenced Almost Famous. And I got to tell you, you probably don't remember this, but I remember it as clearly as if it were yesterday. Sarah McLachlan was in town. Now, you were working at Arista Records. You were doing A&R. That means, for those who don't know, artists and repertoire, where you find artists and you sign them to the label and you help them, you know, you oversee the creation of a record. So you were doing A&R for Arista, and another guy who worked with you in A&R, a guy named Jason was a good friend of mine, and Sarah McLachlan was in town.
Yeah.
And so I met Jason at the Arista building. We were going to go to the show together. And I pulled into the parking lot, and there you were with Cameron Crowe.
Right. Okay.
And you introduced me to Cameron Crowe. And at that time, I was on the air in Los Angeles at this very, very cool radio station, KSCA. And I'm just, like, starstruck. And you said, Nicole Sandler, Cameron Crowe. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm your biggest fan. And he said, wait a minute, but I'm your fan. And it was one of those... Wow. And then we're at the concert, and after the show, we're waiting backstage to, you know, to say hello to Sarah McLachlan. And Cameron and I are standing there next to each other saying, isn't this like the most awkward thing? Because you meet someone and what do you say? Yeah, hi, I'm a big fan. Duh. You know, and so we had that little small talk exchange, and it was just a moment that I will always remember because I'm a big fan of his.
That was 1997, and I was kind of nearing the end of my run with Arista, and I had really stayed in touch with Cameron since the single soundtrack, and did a lot with him with Rip and Headbangers and Pirate Radio. I had him on my radio show twice, and when Jerry Maguire broke, I sent him a long email that said, "This is your time. You're going to kick." The movie The Bodyguard had come out, and I go, "You're going to kick this movie's ass."
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed in touch, and when I was coming to the end of the run with Arista, I said, I'm going to get the limo, I'm going to charge it to the company, and I want to take you to Lilith Fair to see Sarah McLachlan, because he was a huge fan and he had never met her, and I had met her several times because she was on Arista, and she was such an angel. She had lunch one day at the office. She came in barefoot. It was really cool. and he goes, let's go. And he came to the office. You happened to serendipitously be there.
Yeah.
And Jason. And we spent the entire day and night together. And that was a really magical time for me because, I mean, Cameron to me represents, like, he is the symbol of somebody who followed their heart into exactly what they were meant to do with their life and their career.
Yeah, and he couldn't have been a nicer guy too. And he actually sent me the nicest email after that, saying what, you know, how thrilled he was to meet me. I'm like, me? What?
He's a true fan. And when I was getting the galleys of Life on Planet Rock together in 2005, the first person I sent my galley to was Cameron, asking him if he would give me the first quote on the back of my book, which he did. And that meant a lot to me. And he's just great, you know. And I follow all of his films, and I don't see him that often. I mean, we kind of ran into each other when Pearl Jam played the Forum, but I didn't really get to spend any time with him. He's like across the room. But he just continues to just like be out there doing good things for people, and he never sold out, which is, I admire that about people, because you find a lot of people that get successful are going to make bad films or do something that's contrary to who they are. And he's never done that.
Right. And he, you know, he's married to Nancy Wilson of Heart, and they still have a great marriage from everything I know. And they stay out of the stuff, out of the, you know, the tabloids, the spotlight, and just live their lives.
Yeah. He's a good role model for people that you can make it and you can do good things and you don't have to get corrupted or messed up on drugs and self-destructive or be a victim of celebrity. You can stay a good guy. You know, that's why his website used to be so cool. It was called The Uncool, which was taken from the movie Almost Famous, which, I will say this flatly, is my favorite rock and roll movie of all time, is because that film just nailed the heart of why we love music. It just
right, came. And it's sort of, I mean, you did that years later with sort of the next generation. I think you even said he had the Led Zeppelins and the Yeah. Right, and then you had the Guns N' Roses and the Metallica. So, all right, so Lon Friend is with us here. Let's talk a little bit. You know, we've got to get a little dirt. Who of all the, you know, Axl Rose or the guys from Kiss or whoever that you bonded with, who was, like, the nicest, most genuine, and who was the weirdest?
Well, you know, there's something about artists. They get eccentric.
Mm-hmm.
People that I think that I have stayed in touch with, and believe me, when you leave the grid, when you're not holding the keys to the kingdom, when you disappear for a while into whatever place you go, the people that stay with you are the ones that I still call my friends and I still admire. Everybody kissed my ass for that period of time because I had the power.
Right.
But after you lose the power and you disappear for a while and all you do is become a writer and you start examining things. The folks that I stayed in touch with that I still love to this day, and I'll drop the names, are Scott Ian from Anthrax, Nuno Bettencourt from Extreme, Chris Cornell, Lars Ulrich from Metallica, who invited me to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, who picked up my tab. I mean, that was a fantastic night to be there. Metallica flew about 150 people in from all over the world who had been part of their journey, who helped them get to where they were. To Cleveland, to be.
Wow, how nice.
Now that's, listen, if there, I can't say that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has been in any way corrupted, but it is an institution and it does answer to a certain hierarchy. But that was the coolest thing any band had ever done as far as, you know, and that kind of an institution doesn't allow itself to have that sort of behavior, right? And they had all these fans sitting in the section. They threw a party for them at the House of Blues the night before, and they jammed, and it was the best. It was just the best.
Mm-hmm.
It was really cool. It was given back, and that's what artists sometimes forget to do, is to give back to the fans.
Yep.
You know.
All right, and then how about on the other side? Who's disappointed you?
It's sort of been my ethos the last few years to try to take the high road, but
mm-hmm.
you know, when you read my book, you'll see that I take a little bit of a shot at Jon Bon Jovi because I was so intimate with that band and I traveled so many places with them, and there was a point where I was like reaching, you know, the lower rungs of my existence, and I just asked them, you know, to take care of me because I went out on a limb for this event that they did for the QVC network, and I thought it was a sellout event, but I kept myself on air and I talked about the music and I made it look like Bon Jovi was there for the fans when they were there to sell DVDs.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a shot at them, but even that, I mean, you get to a point where you're so big, you just are so iconic and removed from the street. And that's what's happened with John, is just, I always liked him as a person, but he never really revealed himself to me. It was Richie and the other guys who truly revealed themselves to me. But I don't expect that veneer of stardom to be broken that easily. I mean, that's what I've learned. Gene Simmons is the same way. He is frightfully honest, and I had great times on the road with him. But he was always about the cash. He was always about the chicks. He was he was transparent. Yet there was something that there was no soul behind the stuff that he was preaching. And I interviewed him in 2000, and I started to get into some sort of off the grid conversation with him. And he almost got defensive because he's very stubborn about how he sees the universe. You know.
Hmm. Okay.
But I sort of, you know, in my life now that I've got this sense of detachment where what other people think about me doesn't mean as much as it used to. I have always spoken to the fan more closely than I ever did to the executives or the musicians. I think the fan understands me and that I'm always out for their best interest. And that's what you do too, because that's why we do media.
That's right.
That's why we're in media.
Well, you know, I when people email me, and there are times when you just get too busy and you can't, but I've always, ever since email started, boy, I feel old, I always thought if a listener is going to take the time to send me an email and especially a thoughtful email where, you know, they took some time to write something, I'm going to respond.
Absolutely.
Because it is, radio is a very personal medium. It's one-on-one. And so I do that. I mean, if I don't respond to some, if someone sends me an email and I don't respond to them, it's, I just got distracted and something came up, because I try to respond to each and every email. And it's, it amazes me some of the responses I get where, you know, I can't believe you wrote back to me, and I can't believe that people don't.
When my book came out, I launched a MySpace page, and it was really just to help promote my book, to get it out there. But I got notes back that were 6-7 paragraphs long. Lon Friend, dude, I grew up on Rip Magazine. You're the reason why I learned about rock and roll. Your article on so-and-so. And when you get that stuff, because, mm-hmm. you know, you're going through depression or you're thinking that nobody cares anymore, you read that, man, you got to respond. And not only do you have to respond, you have to respond with your heart. You can't just, like, slap it or let somebody take your name and throw it on a form mail. You have to put your own self into that kind of communication, because they're out there. They care. They help you sell your book, but they help you keep moving forward, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, Lon Friend, I want to find out what's up next, because I know you got some plans.
Yep.
The book Life on Planet Rock still available, even though today is the third anniversary of its release. Yep, Amazon.com. In fact, there's a link to that from my blog at RadioOrNot.com, and also from the Nicole Sandler Show page at AirAmerica.com. Let's take a break. We'll come back, and I want to find out on what you're working on now, because it sounds really, really exciting. I'm Nicole Sandler with Lon Friend, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler.
Nicole Sandler.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Sandler.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler.
Yes, I am back with Lon Friend. And the music that's playing in the background, oh boy, I heard you for many, many months trying to get us to play this band on the radio, the Bogmen, which was your one signing in Aristo, weren't they? Lon?
That was the video made by Matt Mahurin, who had made the fantastic Metallica Unforgiven video, and everyone at MTV loved it, but Arista was so lame a label that they couldn't get a radio story together, so MTV never added it, and the Bogmen never made it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. Okay, so now, here we are. It's you've got the book out. It's 3 years. You're working on a new book. You're working on a website. What are you doing now?
I'm involved with several projects. Number one is lonfriend.com after eons. I've had the URL for 10 years. It's finally being built. And we have a wonderful designer, and it's I'm going through like years and years of both text, audio, and video archives. I want it to be a really rich community, not just about me and my content, although there are things that fans are going to just eat up, because I just was permitted to go places that other people weren't permitted to go. And I always had either a camera or a tape recorder with me. So there's some wonderful stuff that's going to be on there. It'll launch in about a month, and we're going to have a Rip swag store. The Rip iconic logo, the original logo of Rip Magazine. I have the rights to merchandise, so we're putting some really cool shirts and hats and other things together, and there's going to be a store there. And anybody who kind of was a fan of the mag, that it was important to them, is going to be able to don that Rip logo again in the original form. And that's something that's pretty cool that we're doing. The book that I'm putting together is about 400 pages, 10 years of journals, unfinished chapters, a lot of things that came through me during a time where I was writing without destination, without fee, without deadline. It's real truth. And I think the people that have followed my path the last 10 years are going to appreciate this book, because it's really important that I kind of purge this, and then I want to move into the next part of my writing career.
Which
I have done a lot of random writing the last few years. I did the bio for the All-American Rejects, a new record. I fell in love with those guys. The Interscope people turned me on to them. And I did the liner notes to a special box set that Spearhead and Michael Fronte, who became a friend of mine in the last few years. I've gotten eclectic. You have to, really. But those are the main projects that I'm doing. I'm discussing a TV thing with a certain network that I can't mention right now, but it's kind of evolving pretty cool. And I'm just welcoming whatever comes to me. I'm not looking for anything. I've kind of had like a really weird ride the last few years. I think the stuff that comes to you when you're not looking is the stuff that you're supposed to be involved with.
Yeah, well, it always happens that way.
Yeah,
you know?
Kind of in this surrender state. I learned about surrender from reading The Power of Now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that works.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to be a weird sort of non sequitur, but what's your reaction to all the reaction to Michael Jackson?
Well, to me, Michael Jackson was always this precious, tragic figure that whose music was so substantial, but he got overshadowed by, you know, the self-mutilation and the tabloids. And the day he dies, he all of a sudden becomes this, you know, almost mythical character. And I'm not dispassionate about it. I do understand the adulation and the love. I just think that we as a culture, we're so driven by the tabloid. We're so driven by people's dysfunction, and that made things like more of an event than really was. This is a tragic death of an artist who really wasn't supposed to depart like this. But maybe there's a reason for this too. I mean, I'm the kind of guy who believes that if it's your time, nothing can, you know. It's your time to go. And he had a remarkable half century on the planet.
Yes, he did.
Despite all of his dysfunction and everything else. I love Off the Wall. I still listen to that
record. That was a great record. It was a great record. And he was a talented guy. It's just I was just curious to get your thoughts on it. Lon Friend, it's great catching up with you. If people go to lonfriend.com right now, Lon with two N's, friend, as it sounds, it'll go to the MySpace page, and in about a month, the new website will be up, and we'll definitely keep in touch. It's so great to talk to you and hear what's going on. You sound really good.
I'm going to send you a tight baby doll rip tee.
All right.
You to wear on South Beach.
You got it.